set tonight at 8 o'clock. Welcome to the...
That guy's still speaking with an accent. K2RIW here. At this time, we begin the TechNet, the Mel and Vic Show, as we sometimes call it. Let's see, do I have another radio on here in the house somewhere?
No.
The main purpose of the TechNet is to give people information about this slightly unusual hobby of ham radio. A lot of stuff to learn. Only some of it's covered in books. Only some of it's covered in the courses you can take. So by way of the instruction you're going to get here, you'll hear things that you can't get from other sources. Mel will be giving us his fourth or fifth installment on that very useful technique called a Smith chart. And it's something that's taught at the college level. I think there are very few high schools that teach you how to use a Smith chart. But it tries to answer some of the mystery about how transmission lines really work and how you do impedance matching between various stages of your ham rig, the antenna, the amplifier, the driver stage, and so on. Whenever transmission lines are involved, the Smith chart can help. Whenever you're adding stubs, capacitor inductive stubs to do impedance matching, whenever you're mixing various impedances, you may mix 70-ohm cable and 50-ohm cable, Smith chart can help. I'm also going to be giving you guys a very simple sounding puzzle about a handy talkie. So we'll be getting into that later. The way a person signs into the TechNet is to give Mel and Dick your call letters, your name, and the confirming yes. And the yes means you do have a question or a comment for the net. A typical sign-in would sound like this, N2EO, Rich, and yes, one of our frequent sign-ins. So please give me your call letters and name right now, K2RIW.
Net. JC2MWA, no.
W2JPW, Lou, yes.
W2PIA, good evening, Dick. Lou, no.
Okay, so far we've got Bob, Lou, and Lou. Big Lou and Little Lou. First, Lou number one and Lou number two. With a no on the second one, BIE. Nice hearing from both you guys. Anyone else to check in? Give me your call letters at this time.
I'm here.
Okay, we got Mel and somebody with call letters blank blank Victor Sierra. Give me that full call and name, sir. Okay, Bennett. You're the man, as I remember, who gave me the information on the EH antenna. Very nice package last December. Okay, one last call. Anyone else to check into the TechNet? Give me your call letters and name at this time.
W2PN.
Yeah, I should have mentioned Bob. Already got you. Okay, the first Bob also said no, in MWA. Looks like our first real sign-in tonight is Lou, W2JPW. What's going on over there in New Jersey, the Garden State? You got it, Lou.
Well, I don't know if I'd call it that, but the K2RIW, TechNet, W2JPW. A quick question. Well, actually, it's a two-parter. Very simple. I'm looking for a cheap and dirty way to have it, to put together a high-powered brick amplifier. I wonder if you guys, anybody on here has ever seen any VHF bricks 130, 140, and 180 megahertz, and those bands that would cover 2 meters. And if you could find such items, or even the regular expensive types that you see advertised by Mirage and the other one in QST, nice high power one there in QST for $700 or so, how difficult would it be to run two in parallel? Say you've got to 250 watters, you wanted to get 300 watts. Seems to me the same techniques could be used with phasing lines or so forth that you would use with multiple Yagis. Do something like that. That is an application, I guess, of your, like doing these kind of things is something that I am very, very poor at. I went to RCA Institute many years ago, like 40 years ago or more. We had a Smith chart, a big round thing that we bought, and it was like a slide rule. and I'd love to know what happened to that. I lost it somewhere in the basement. It's long gone. But that was a nice gadget. So that's K2RIW, the TechNet, W2JPW.
Very fine, Lou. Great subject. I've seen those slide rule-like plastic things that come both small and large, but really are a Smith chart where sort of like a circular slide rule. They're kind of rare. There's probably a way, I'm trying to think now, could you use a circular slide rule like a Smith chart? Maybe not. Maybe not. The logarithmic scale, unity at one end and 10 at the other end, so that your so-called CD scales on a slide rule. And so a circular version of that, trying to represent 50 ohms in the center and either zero or infinity at the perimeter, not really logarithmic. So it's a fairly different instrument. Your main subject, though, is on the subject of the amplifiers. Can you combine amplifiers? My goodness, Lou, you came to the right place. I have written no less than 3 articles on that exact subject. What prompted me to write the articles is that from time to time, microwave enthusiasts, the guys that are on 2 gigs, 5 gigs, 10 gigs, or 24 gigs, they always are fighting for more power. Everybody on those bands starts off QRP. You can generate a milliwatt out of a mixer on 10 gigs. You're on the air, and you'll make some QSOs. You add an amplifier, and you bring it up to 200 milliwatts or a watt. In old days, that was considered a full gallon, a 1 watt output on 10 gigs. Nowadays, the state of the art has moved. State amplifiers at the 10 watt, 20 watt level are expensive, but they exist. So obviously, somebody's going to come along and say, I've got 2 amplifiers of 10 watts each. Can I combine them? I've got 2 traveling wave tubes of 20 watts each. Can I combine them? Somebody will always, every year and a half, ask that question on the microwave reflector that's run by Tom Williams, WA1MBA. Somebody comes along and asks that question. He gets an answer, and various people will tell him, well, the way you sum the power between the two has got to be accurate to the nearest couple of degrees in phase, to the nearest couple of tenths of a dB in amplitude balancing, and they give all these logical sounding answers, which are sort of textbook answers. You go to any good textbook that teaches how to combine amplifiers, it's called the hybrid combining situation, and you'll see lots of information indicating that ridiculous accuracy is required. Well, if it's a commercial business and you're manufacturing so-called balanced amplifiers and you want to make sure that you have a high production yield, those kind of accuracies maybe are called for. In reality, how fast do you lose if you're out of phase? If I have a 30-degree phase error or a 60-degree phase error, what happens? If I have a 3-decibel amplitude error, what happens? As I said, I've published a couple of articles on the subject, and you'll discover that until your phase error or your amplitude error become gross, until they become gross errors, the combination will give you 90-some-odd% efficiency almost all the time. It's like falling off a log. Once you've got the right topography of the right kind of circuit and approximately the right phase and approximately the right amplitude, the thing plays like a charm. Summing power is easy. Don't let people scare you. Now, the nicest way to do it is with a kind of directional coupler, which is called a quadrature hybrid. I'm now talking about thoroughly impedance-matched, thoroughly isolation-type summing. Yes, we amateurs all the time will put 2 antennas together with a T-connector and with the right impedances of cable, but with a unterminated T-connector, we can combine 2 antennas and have the right spacing between the antennas and get 3 dB of increase in gain. And can you combine 2 amplifiers with a T-connector? The answer is absolutely yes. Should you do that? I'd say probably not, because most solid-state amplifiers, particularly bipolar transistor amplifiers, your Mirage Baker 1016 is a nice amplifier, rated for 160 watts of output with 10 watts of drive, and as long as you've got a reasonably clean antenna under 2-to-1 standing wave ratio, 90% of the time, it's a stable brick amplifier to be added after the rest of your ham rig, and it does a pretty nice job. The other 10% of the time, if your particular antenna has just the right length of cable, it has just the right short circuit or open circuit characteristic on the second harmonic, a subharmonic, or whatever, 10% of the time that amplifier will take off and oscillate on you. And so you got to readjust the cable length and whatever. You got to do all kinds of fancy things to make that amplifier stable. Combining a pair of those amplifiers with a T connector, something that gives you no isolation, is really a recipe for frustration. I give you a 50% chance of being able to pull that off, which implies there's a 50% chance you're going to have a lot of frustration. A smarter guy will combine in ways that isolate. If you use the right kind of 180-degree hybrid or a 90-degree hybrid, which is also or even a Wilkinson hybrid, these are the three most popular hybrids. Wilkinson is a 0 dB hybrid. Quadrature is like a directional coupler hybrid. And a ring coupler, 180-degree hybrid. All three of those hybrids have a termination associated with them. The Wilkinson has a 100-ohm resistor inside. The others have a 50-ohm resistor somewhere in the system. When hooked up properly, they will sum every bit of that power from your two amplifiers, even if the amplifiers are not perfectly amplitude matched and not perfectly impedance matched. But when that hybrid is working correctly, those two amplifiers are thoroughly isolated from each other. Each amplifier thinks there's nothing out there except 50-ohm hardware plus your antenna. They don't know that there's another amplifier in the vicinity by which signals can be bouncing back and forth between the two like they would with a T-connector, and therefore the whole system can take off and oscillate. So, can you combine? Absolutely. If I find that article that I've written, I'm guessing, Lou, that you've got a website, an email address at w2jpw@arrl.net or something like that. If I find one of those times that I've written an article on what happens as a function of imbalance, I think if we go to the Roadrunners W5, DMG is it? Anyhow, the Roadrunners Microwave Group in Texas has some very nice articles on things like this, as well as on transformers. I believe they may have reproduced one of my articles on hybrids there. If not, I'll get you a copy of it. So fret not, fear not. Don't let people discourage you. You go on 20 meters and you tell somebody you're going to combine amplifiers, and you're going to get a zillion people coming at you saying that, hey, Lou, you're crazy. It ain't going to work. It's fraught with problems, and there's only 10 ways that it can go wrong. You're going to get lots of naysayers telling you not to do it. I'm telling you, go do it. And with a little bit of smarts, it's a beautiful thing to do. It will make you happy. W2JPW, about to be QRO, K2RIW in the TechNet.
K2RIW, W2JPW. Very good. Thanks, Dick. Question, mentioned three different kinds of hybrids, the Wilkinson, the Quadrature, and what was the third one?
180-degree ring hybrid. There's ways of taking coax cable and hooking lens together into a ring of coax cable with connectors in various places, and that's called a sum and difference hybrid or 180-degree hybrid, sometimes also called a magic T, so a coax version of a magic T. So that's the third one. The second one was the quadrature coupler or 90-degree hybrid, as it's called, quadrature hybrid, or directional coupler. That's at least three names, and the first one was Wilkinson. Wilkinson is the one that starts off with a pair of 70-ohm lines that are a quarter wave long coming together at a common point. That's your antenna in your case. And the other two connectors have a coax connector going to the 70-ohm cable and a 100-ohm resistor internal that floats. So that's Wilkinson. And all three of those that I just mentioned, properly connected, will sum all your power with a ridiculously high efficiency, 99% efficiency of the hybrid itself, if it's reasonably well constructed, and they create this beautiful characteristic of isolation between the amplifiers. And you, with bipolars, you definitely need that. Back to you, Lou.
Okay, Dick. Well, these hybrids of the three types they're all things you could build yourself, or is this, or is the one of them a commercial job?
Without a doubt, all three of them can be built yourself, Lou. The Wilkinson hybrid is the easiest because at 2 meters or 432, it just consists of a shielded box, three connectors, a pair of 70 ohm cables that are a quarter wavelength long electronically, and a high power 100 ohm resistor. Most likely it's going to be one of these heat sump type resistors. You'd like a low inductance or low reactance 100 ohm resistor for Wilkinson. Wilkinson's the easiest one to build, except for the 100 ohm termination. If you're using a pair of, let's say, 100 watt amplifiers, you'd like that to be a 100 ohm termination. And that represents a little bit of a difficulty for the average guy. A low inductance, low capacitance, 100 ohm resistor. All the others need only ordinary coaxial 50 ohm dummy loads in order to create the isolation. The quadrature hybrid, the directional coupler type, occasionally they appear at flea markets when it comes to microwave frequencies. Down to 432 and 2 meters, they are a bit rare. With strip line techniques and microstrip and coplanar strip line or triplate strip line, without a doubt, if you choose the right article, Reed Fisher, W2CQH, had a series of articles in QST magazine all way back in the early 70s on how to build with pieces of sheet metal quadrature hybrids with triplate strip line. In other words, an upper sheet, a lower sheet, and a circuit in between that's made out of sheet of copper or brass or whatever, and connectors mounted in this whole structure. And so he was combining power from 432 and 1296 transmitters. So one way or another, we'll find you an article on how to build these things. That's the quadrature coupler. The 180 degree ring coupler, that can be done with pieces of coax cable and T connectors. So once you find the right article, now that you've got the buzzwords, and you go to a Google search on those buzzwords, you're going to find 50 articles, and now your biggest problem is going to be to choose the one that's easiest for you to build with the stuff that happens to be in your particular junk box. W2JPW, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Should I let him go first?
Yeah. K2JJ, go right ahead.
Yeah, good evening, Dick. Just curious, what side of these, say, has a pair of amplifiers, hybrid is on the output, finally the power. Is kind of power divider on the input?
Absolutely, positively. Awful glad you mentioned that, Doug. Yeah. Without a doubt, whatever your source of power is, you have to divide it to get it into the two amplifiers and then bring it back together. So whatever hybrid technique you build, you're going to be building a pair of them. A pair of Wilkinson, a pair of 180 degrees, or a pair of the quadrature type. The quadrature type is the nicest one to build. The reason for that, if you study what's called a balanced amplifier, almost all solid-state amplifiers, 97% of the high-quality solid-state amplifiers you can buy these days for commercial service, 100 to 10,000 megacycle commercial service, you go to the Mitek catalog, the Solaritech catalog, the Amplica, and as the old days, I'm trying to say, Avantech. There's a lot of good brand names out there of so-called balanced amplifiers. The reason they use a quadrature coupler on the input and a quadrature coupler on the output, quadrature hybrid input and output, is not only does it create isolation between the two amplifiers, but when you properly hook up those quadrature hybrids, the amplifier becomes extremely low in standing wave ratio on both the input side and the output side. You get twice the power output, all the gain you're entitled to, complete isolation between the two amplifiers, and each individual amplifier may have had a 3-to-1 standing wave ratio on the input, and maybe a 5-to-1 standing wave ratio on the output. And I'm not kidding. Many well-tuned solid-state amplifiers start off with those kind of input and output standing wave ratios. You hook them up with a quadrature hybrid on the input, a quadrature hybrid on the output, across the frequency range where the hybrid is designed, you will see under 1.1 standing wave ratio on the input across the whole frequency range and on the output across the whole frequency range. just as long as your two amplifiers, no matter how bad they are, as long as they're matched. As long as you can build a pair of identical amplifiers, amplitude and phase characteristics, so to speak, then the hybrids will give you that beautiful advantage. So it's a good subject to study, Lou. If you want to dig into the mathematics of it and really learn what's going on, the man who won a whole bunch of awards for discovering this is a guy named Kurakawa. K-U-R-A-K-O-W-A. I may have the spelling a little bit wrong. Kurakawa. Anyhow, Kurakawa Amplifiers. K-U-R-O-K-A-W-A. K-U-R-O-K-A-W-A. You do a Google search on that word, and you'll find this beautiful RF microwave engineer who developed the technique and got all kinds of awards for it. That's what a balanced amplifier really is. When you talk to your really well-informed people in the microwave world, and they're talking about a balanced amplifier, you say, oh, you're talking about a Kurakawa. Their eyes will light up, that you suddenly show greater than normal intelligence. Back to you, Lou.
Okay, Dick, thanks. You know, I saw a ring hybrid way back in the 1950s in QST. I wish I knew where that magazine was. It was exactly how to build it. It was for some kind of radio astronomy project or something. It was way back, almost 50 years ago. So they're not new. But the others I know nothing about except what you've already told me. Well, very interesting. Now all I have to do is find out where I can get two amps that are not outrageously expensive and do this. I have one 250 watt here. I'd love to find another one like that, but problem with it, I don't even have any idea if it works. I picked it up for $50 from a guy one time, and it was supposedly it worked, but I've never put it on a power supply to find out. So if I could find another one like that, pair them up, half a kilowatt, which would be just lovely. Thanks a lot, Dick. As far as my website is, I don't have a website, but I do have an email at ARRL, but I don't think it's working right. I have to go tomorrow and fix it if you're going to send me something. I've been meaning to do this, never get around to it. I think I've got the wrong email address in there from my old service, and I changed since, so I'll do that tomorrow, and you'll be able to get me. I am a member of ARRL, and I do have it up there. K2RIW, and thank you again, W2JPW.
Very fine, Lou. See what I can do in finding you some more information on the subject, but it's a beautiful subject. Whenever anyone appears on the microwave reflector with a discussion of this, a zillion people come out of the woodwork telling him how difficult it is and they shouldn't be doing it. More naysayers out there. And it's not based on bad experience. It's based on bad instruction. When you take a balanced amplifier instruction at any of the normal schools, for reasons I don't understand, they lead you that ridiculous amplitude and phase balancing is required. Don't develop it mathematically. They just state those words. In other words, it's one of these old wives' tales that got started somewhere. Each instructor hears it and passes it on. And it's not based on fact. It's based on a belief. It's based on tea leaves, if you know what I mean. So don't be discouraged on this one. I've done lots of power combining, and my greatest run was a buddy of mine named Bill one time came to me with a pair of 250-watt traveling wave tube amplifiers that we use on an electronic news gathering truck. In other words, one of these trucks that go around to places where news needs gathered and sent back by satellite. And so they needed 500 watts in the uplink, and at the time the thing was designed, only 250 watts was available. So a pair of 250-watt 15 gigahertz traveling wave tubes, we're talking about $25,000 tubes here, a pair of them, were being combined in a quadrature hybrid in order to make the 500 watts of uplink power for a particular satellite on this portable truck. And so phase matching and amplitude matching was required in that case because a failure of the traveling wave tube or its power supply was creating numbers like 160 degrees of phase shift, and therefore the power was not coming correctly. We're not talking about the normal couple of degrees of accuracy that people think that is required, that particular system, because of a failure of a power supply. One of the That well-known characteristics of a traveling wave tube is that it can create tremendous amounts of phase shift. It can easily create 360 degree of phase shift within the amplifying tube itself if you make a relatively minor shift of about 20 volts on one of the high voltage power supplies feeding the cathode helix potential into that tube. The tube itself has got 15 wavelengths of helix, and so you can get one wavelength of shift by shifting the voltage a little bit, changes the velocity factor of the electron beam going down that helix. Rather magic tube. Under certain circumstances, that phase shift capability can be used to great advantage. But if something funny goes on with your power supply, so if the voltage regulator doesn't work correctly, that characteristic of a traveling wave tube can come back and bite you very seriously. So if you're trying to combine two tubes, it will drive you crazy. Okay, Lou is the next guy who signed in who claims he's just listening. We're going to give him a chance to talk if he wants to. Bennett's the next guy with a real question. N2, Fox Victor Sierra, I think it is. You got the floor, Bennett. K2RIW in the tech net.
Can I just ask one quick question?
Yeah, go right ahead, Doug.
It's Lou. Why do they need 150-watt traveling wave tube? Were they using a dipole antenna for the uplink for that satellite? I never heard of 15 gig, 150 watts. That's absurd. Go ahead.
Okay, it's worse than you think. Each tube was capable of 250 watts of output. They needed 500 watts of total uplink power because they were running something like a, maybe it was a 2-meter dish. In other words, the dish was already 6 foot in diameter. That was the biggest they could easily pack onto the top of the truck on an American telescoping mast. If they were using a ground station with a 30-foot dish, yeah, 150 watts would do it. Because they were limited in the dish size of this electronic news gathering portable truck that had to be easily driven from point A to point B, because the dish size was limited, and because the satellites in the old day were not quite as sensitive as they are today, and you're talking 23,000 miles to a satellite in space. 6 Earth radii is the distance out there that satellite is at. And you get 250 dB of loss or some crazy number like that. So 500 watts was required to give a snow-free picture in the uplink of that satellite. Back to you on that one, Lou.
Vic, call soon.
Okay, I understand, Vic. Thanks. They were using a 1N21 as a receiver up there. the distance is enormous, yeah. Thank you very much. Up to the next guy now, W2JPW.
On that exact subject, we have a man who has hands-on experience doing that. My buddy Bill, W2 Quebec Valve Zulu. Bill, give us a few words on that one.
Hey, good evening, W2QG. Yeah, no, you're right. It's a 1.8 meter antenna. That was the minimum amount of reflector you could use and still be suitably compliant at the time. That was the smallest antenna you could possibly use, and you had to hurl massive amounts of power heavenward in order to try to get anything on the other end. Now, some of the other trucks he worked with, which had only marginally larger antennas, but on a bigger truck chassis so they could support them, did require drastically less power. But that was the story, and you remember just about right at the sign. W2QGZ.
Yeah. Not only did Bill operate that truck from various places around the United States, but at one time he operated all of that portable equipment in China, which I think was part of during one of the Olympic Games. And I believe also an attempt was made to operate that equipment in the Caribbean. So so-called flyaway systems. In other words, if the system is well designed, it's possible to put the traveling wave tube in one box, the power supply in another box, the antenna in another box, and so on. And all of these things in the old days, before 9/11, could go as baggage on an airliner. And you could buy all this hardware as flyaway hardware. That's the name is very classic, very descriptive. You could go from point A to point B on an airliner, set up all of this equipment in some god-awful place, send an uplink, and talk to the people back home, so to speak, with a snow-free broadcast quality picture. And so that's an exciting business to be in, but you get into some of the war stories with Bill someday over a couple of beers, and you'll find out it's not quite as glamorous as at first it sounds. wonder if you want to throw in a couple more words on that one, Bill, while we got you. Because talk to Bill when you get a chance. He's got some great stories. WB2? Mr. QG said, you tell you the KQLIW on the tech net.
Everything can be pretty much summed up in show me the money. it was some challenging places to be. The other thing is, real quick, for some reason, the satellite operators wanted to have a pretty substantial amount of attenuation in their front ends to protect them. And that was one of the other issues we were working, especially a lot of the Intelsat satellites trying to come out of weird places. And the other issue with them is sometimes it's KU up and C-band down, so you're even having a hard time spotting yourself. But we were operating with satellites that had up to 9 dB of front-end attenuation switched in by the satellite operator for protection. Now, sometimes we could get them to take 6 dB out, and I was like, well, a little switch up in space for a lot of raw power down here. But that was one of our other issues. And I have not done that in a little while, so I'm not sure what the story is with that today. But that was all state of the art in approximately 1990, 95, something like that. WB2QG said.
Very kind, Bill. And I get some guesses as to what's going on there. Your satellite itself, to launch something into space 22,300 miles up, you're going to spend a couple of $100 million just to be on board the booster that'll take you there. The hardware itself of the satellite is another couple of $100 million. I'm rounding off the numbers, but it's in that ballpark. So we're talking about a good fraction of $1 billion requires to get that bird in space. When you finally get it there, you want to treat it with tender loving care. You want to get 10 or 15 years of service out of it. And one of the worst things you've got to worry about is if the low noise amplifier in the front end of that satellite suddenly sees a burst of RF energy, an electromagnetic pulse that creates damage to that amplifier. Life gets very ugly after that if you lose that front end amplifier. So they love to operate it with a 6 or a 9 dB attenuator in front of it. That stops somebody with a high power radar or with an HPM, high power microwave, is a whole branch of electronic warfare techniques. There are techniques of building very specialized amplifiers that for a 1 microsecond period of time produces tremendous amounts of power, which can create damage to the electronics of your adversary. And so if somebody aims one of those things at you, or if Mother Nature decides to create one of those super lightning bolts right on the chunk of space that your antenna is aimed at, there's a bunch of ways in which tremendous amounts of energy could be collected by your great big dish in space, all of it directed at your tiny little amplifier, which probably has a gate on it that is, when it forces everybody on the ground. On the Cedar Hill, right outside of Dallas, is where all the broadcast stations are located. So there is this 1,800-foot high tower that was recently installed with a beautiful Channel 2 broadcast antenna. And the antenna is installed, the tower is up, but the transmitter hasn't yet arrived. So he has been given permission on various weekends to hook up his 6-meter rig to that antenna. When he does that, he can be talking to somebody some ridiculous distance away when the band is not open, and they'll tell him, "Hey, Kent, you must be running an awful lot of power. You are loud." "No, I'm running 100 watts." To which they, "Boy, you must be running one hell of an antenna." To which, "Huh? The antenna has got something like 12 dB of gain." "Well, that sounds like a pretty long boom Yagi. My antenna must be pretty high up." Kent says, "Yeah, it's 1,700 feet up from the center of the antenna." That's how high the center of that broadcast tower is that's got the broadcast antenna. The antenna is tuned for 54 to 60 megs, and it's a little bit off-tuning at the 50.125 where he uses it. So on 2 or 3 weekends so far, he gets on 6 meters and 1,800-foot high antenna. Which, by the way, because we've gone through all the questions, as soon as we finish with you, Ben, all the people who signed in, who said they've got a question, I'm going to hit you guys with something that's very relevant to that. That is, if somebody asks you, what's the range of a handy talkie on 2 meters? Each one of us has got real experience on that. I mean, if I take my IC2AT ICOM handy talkie, 1985 vintage, I own about five of those down things, and I hand one of them to my son, and I hand one of them to my daughter, and we go to some place like Disney World or whatever, and we want to talk to each other. And periodically we get on the handy talkies and say, okay, let's meet at the lunch counter because it's 1 o'clock in the afternoon. Let's all get together and see, you know, compare notes where we've been at Disney World and so on. So a handy talkie in that circumstance, or by the same token, you hand one of those things to a friend of yours, have him walk down the street in front of your house, and you stand in the house and you talk to him. By the time you get a mile away, you have medium good coverage, but not perfect. It's a little bit terrain sensitive. There's a great big woods or a lot of hill in between. You may not make it to a mile. If your QTH is on a nice high hill on Long Island in Huntington, like I am, and somebody goes walking down the hill, well, maybe you're going to talk 3 or 4 miles. But if I ask you guys, what is the true range of a pair of identical IC2AT handy talkies under reasonably good condition? What kind of range in miles would you guys say that radio is good for? Give me a couple of answers right now. Give me a call letters. KQRIW the TechNet.
W2JPW.
Lou recognized. Lou and Mel recognize. Anyone else?
N2MB.
N2Moonbound. Oh, okay. He may have some interesting information. I should almost disqualify you, Barry, but we'll get to him. And anyone else? Okay, Lou first. I think it was Lou. Go ahead, tell us your guess. How good is a handy talkie? What kind of range can you get out of it in miles?
Well, if you're flying in a plane at 20,000 feet and you have a ground station with the identical handy talkie, say he's on top of a control tower or something where he's got a good view of the field or the surrounding area, say 40, 50 feet off the ground, I would say 250, 300 miles. Is a good guess. That's what most of the charts in the aeronautical books that discuss air ground communication give you for a height of 20,000 feet. Go ahead.
John, good answer. So at 20,000 feet, 250 to 300 miles is Lou's answer. Mel, what's your answer? What kind of range can you get out of a pair of IC2ATs?
Well, they did that experiment. Those guys were doing it, were trying to establish, you know, distance record. And they did it between, some years ago, between two mountains, or mountains, and they were running 5-watt handy talkies, but using, I think they may have had some kind of enhanced, so the idea basically is just what they had is to establish what can be done, you know, with handy talkie. I believe it was sponsored by either ICOM or Kenwood at the time. And the record was 375 miles as the crow flies.
I top that. Okay. So we've got the Lou 250 to 300. You're saying 379. And in a way, I top that. But I'm going to get you that in a minute. Yeah, Oscar 10 does have a quad helix antenna, and it's got some gain to it. So it's a little bit unfair to talk handy-talkie to handy-talkie. Okay. I personally, with handy-talkie to handy-talkie, made a QSO. Roughly 1,500 miles. And I decided tonight to do a quick calculation as to what's possible. A good handy talkie, one that you and I can buy, you put them onto a piece of laboratory test equipment, and you measure 12 dB sign-in or 20 dB quieting, they're in the vicinity of half a microvolt. So here's a handy thing to remember. 1 microvolt is minus 107 dBm. In the RF world, you're going to spend half your life converting back and forth between reflection coefficient and standing wave ratio. When it comes to receiver sensitivity, you're going to spend half your life flipping back and forth between microvolts and decibels with reference to a millivolt, a milliwatt. That's what dBm means. dB means dB with reference to a milliwatt, dBm. 0 dBm is 1 milliwatt. And remember that dBs are always a ratio. And 0 dB is not zero signal. It's just a 0 dB of ratio, and when you do an anti-log of 0, it happens to be unity. So 1-to-1 ratio is 0 dB of difference. So 0 dBm is 1 milliwatt. All right. Because 1 microvolt is minus 107 therefore a half a microvolt, half the voltage, one quarter the power, because power is a function of E squared over R, voltage squared. One quarter of the power is 6 dB more. 6 dB more than minus 107 is minus 113. So therefore, if you had a good laboratory signal generator, you would find out that your handy-talkie on 2 meters at minus 113 dBm on the dial out of the signal generator is the threshold of where you get the 12 dB of synod or 20 dB of quieting. So now we know what the receiver needs. 8 dBm, 30 dBm signal, 5 watts is 7 dB more than that. And by the way, when it comes to decibels, there's a couple of easy memory schemes. You think around 3 dB, 5 dB, 7 dB, and 10 dB. 3 dB is 2 to 1 in power. 4 dB, correction, 6 dB is 4 to 1 in power. You could say it's twice 2 to 1 in power. 4 to 1 in power is 6 dB. 2 to 1 in power is 3 dB. So 3 and 6 are pretty easy to remember. 10 to 1 in power is 10 decibels, because the log of 10 is 1, multiplied by 10, and you get 10 decibels. So 3 dB, 6 dB, and 10 dB, pretty easy points to remember. 10 dB, 10 to 1 in power. Half of 10 to 1 in power is 5 to 1 in power. Half of 5 to 1 is a 3 dB difference. A 3 dB difference from 10 is 7. So a 5 to 1 7 dB, therefore your handy-talkie puts out 37 dBm, plus 37. So between plus 37 dBm, transmit power, and I'm assuming the rubber duck antenna is 0 dB of gain. I'm being conservative here. 0 dB of gain out of the rubber duck. Minus 113 is what we said was the receiver threshold. Plus 37 dBm is your transmitter power output. That's a ratio of 150. The power spread that your handy-talkie can tolerate is 150 decibels. That's the difference between the max power output it puts on transmit.
A zero gain antenna is half loss, 1 mile stretch on 2. Very interesting. It's a great formula. See, you learn something new every segment. Thank you.
Another happy customer. We're going to send you the bill. Mel and I are going to send you a bill. I wonder if anyone's got any further questions or comments on this subject. But yeah, as you can see, the way radio works, the first mile is 99% of the loss. That's crazy. The first mile is where most of the loss exists. And every time you double the distance from there, you're only adding 6 more dB of loss. Almost 80 dB of loss is the first mile on 2 meters. So because your handy-talkie is capable of 150 dB of power spread, that's the difference between transmit power and receive sensitivity, 150, and 1 mile is only 80 dB, and since handy-talkies in an urban environment are only reliable for about a mile, handy-talkie to handy-talkie, in urban environment, or maybe with a whole lot of trees and whatever. Since the first mile is giving you 80 dB of loss, and the handy-talkie is capable of overcoming 150, the difference between those two numbers is 70 dB. In other words, in that mile, in many conditions, the buildings, the trees, the water towers, the houses, the earth curvature, and all of that is giving 70 decibels of extra loss there. Space to ground, 3,100 miles, handy-talkie to handy-talkie. On the earth, a mile is about all you can get reliably, unless somebody is on the 18th floor of a building, on a mountaintop, on flat land where there's no trees, and so on. On average, in the first mile, the terrain is giving you close to 70 dB of loss. That's amazing. However, if you think about how that signal is getting there, if you and your buddy are doing this handy-talkie measurement, and you're standing with your good set of telescope or binoculars on a tripod as he looks a mile away from you. By the time he gets a quarter of a mile, in most environments, you're going to lose sight of him. You are not line of sight. That signal that gets between your handy-talkie and his handy-talkie is bouncing off of 1,000 trees, 1,000 bricks on buildings, a whole bunch of wiring in buildings, off the ground, off the ionosphere, off water towers, off all kinds of jazz. That signal, if your eye could see all the paths that signal is taking,
to go from point A to point B a mile apart in an urban environment. You'd be every one of those paths is operative simultaneously. All those voltages of all those paths are all taking place at once. And at the receiving site on that rubber duck, all those voltages in microvolts are being added together. And they come up with some kind of a sum signal of around half a microvolt or so, and you hear the guy talking to you. All those signals, whenever you transmit a signal, it goes to every cubic centimeter of this universe. Every one of those paths is operative at every instant of time. All those paths add up in voltage, and the only thing to discuss is when the signal gets there, above the threshold of the receiver you're now using, transmit a radio signal, it goes to every single spot in this universe. It takes some time to get there, but it gets there. And in some cases, it's not above the random motion of the local electrons, and therefore the signal-to-noise ratio is going to be terrible. You're not getting above the Nyquist criteria or whatever. But anyhow, what I'm getting at is the signal, once you create a signal, once you push that handy-talkie, once you press that push-to-talk button, you're sending a signal everywhere in the universe. Gives you a funny way of looking at things if you start thinking about UFOs being monitored and stuff like that. Anyway, any further questions or comments? KQRIW in the TechNet.
NQMD.
Barry, recognize?
White.
Barry and Mendel in that order. Barry, go right ahead. And I bet you've done some good space communicating in your time.
Yeah, I just wanted to bring up several EC4K. I can't remember the beginning, but it's the call letters for that part of the world, but it was KPY was the last three letters of this call. And he was transmitting, and he thought he was transmitting originally with a...